You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 462 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton,
and I'm Tristan Garcia.
And we're coming to you in separate locations this week. I'm in Seattle, Washington, home of the four-time WNBA champion Storm.
And I'm coming to you from Brenton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. You said we only have an hour and 6 minutes. We're doing it fast. I'm talking in double time. Let's fucking go.
Wow. We're just going to give people 1.25 speed?
Yes.
They didn't ask for it?
Yes, they are.
What if we make it like the Micro Machines commercials? Are we capable of keeping this pace up for an entire hour? I don't think we can do it.
Timely reference. Bad draft.
All right. Well, I should have said, by the way, it's also the home of the first place Seattle Mariners in the ALS. Let's do the toast and then we'll do the semi-emergency pod on the Seahawks draft. Okay.
Oh, I thought the semi-emergency pod was on the fucking Mariners.
It's on Jorge Polanco and what his extension might look like.
Oh God.
Congrats to Cal Raleigh, who became the 16th Mariners player to reach. Was this from last week? No, this is still this week. To reach 100 career home runs by hitting one from each side of the plate last Wednesday in Cincinnati. That feels like a very long time ago.
Wow. Last Wednesday in Cincinnati? That was like 2 weeks ago that series happened. There's no
way. Oh, you're right. I pulled up the wrong. I pulled up the old notes to copy something over from them.
We're like, doing it much faster. We have to be much more precise with our information.
All right. Well, congrats to AL Player of the Week, Jorge Polanco, who
hit
471 with four home runs and eight RBIs. The Mariners went 4-2 last week. It's the first time the Mariners have had back-to-back AL Players of the Week since 25% Seattle Sports Figure of the Year, Alex Rodriguez,
yes,
and Ken Griffey Jr. on June 27th, July 4th, 1998. How hyped would we have been on July 4th, 1998?
I mean, that's probably like if you could pinpoint the best day of our life.
Oh, no.
It's I thought
that's when we got
there.
The Super Nintendo.
That's pretty high. I can't muse, but I will say I was Luca. I was like, we've been listening to a lot of like old school rap songs because it's sunny outside, and I'm just like, this is what you do.
Wow, the Mariners were extremely terrible at this point.
Were they?
The pitching must have been quite awful. This was before they traded Randy Johnson. But they were 37-50.
You listen to when it's
this had to be 97. I must have written down the wrong years, right?
Okay, we're being a lot more precise here because we have to do this fast. You have to stop being wrong about things all the time. The ESPN senior writer Kevin Pelton. But I was telling Luca the song "Hip Hop Hooray" came on, and I was like, "You don't know what it's like having Ken Griffey Jr. when you're a kid and the song "Hip Hop Hooray" coming on. Like it is just there's not a thing comparable to it." And then I was like, it's kind of like when Jorge Polanco comes to the plate now. The spiritual heir to Ken Griffey Jr.
My favorite part of this, it is June 27th and July 4th. So they awarded it on a Saturday?
Oh my God,
that doesn't make sense.
We do not have time for this.
All right, fine. Anyway, it's going to be really exciting when Dylan Moore buys the Memphis Grizzlies. Because he's like A-Rod. That was the joke. Congrats to Carson Bruner, who was drafted in the 7th round of the NFL draft by the Pittsburgh Steelers, the lone Husky drafted this year after the very heavy Husky 2024 draft. This is, of course, a family affair. His dad and fellow Husky alum Mark Bruner, a scout for the Steelers, after playing the first 9 seasons of his 14-year NFL career.
A family affair is the nicest way to say Nepo.
Nepo, baby.
A family affair. Gracie Abrams' career is just a family affair. no, she's great. Anyway.
This was part of the being precise? That
the Carson Bruner, here's the thing. You say the Huskies had almost nobody drafted this year, one player drafted. I say that's great news because that means a lot of dogs are coming back for next season. Players being drafted is nice, but what happens after you have a bunch of players drafted is you go 7-6 or whatever they went last year, 6-7.
Correct.
So we don't need players drafted. We're good.
Congrats to Ezzy Megbegor, who helped USK Praha sweep the Czech League Finals for a domestic title to go with their EuroLeague Championship. A very busy and successful offseason for Ezzy Megbegor before she reported to Storm training camp starting on Sunday. All right, and then lastly this week, congrats to Seattle, which will officially join the Professional Women's Hockey League as an expansion franchise in 2025-26, as previously reported. The team will play at Climate Pledge Arena with colors of emerald green and cream. The league began with six teams in 2023-24, two in Canada, three in the Northeast, one in Minnesota is the Western outpost at that point, and is owned by the family of Dodgers chairman Mark Walter in a single entity model. Vancouver also coming online for 2025-26, so very exciting.
Joining
to
Banff, of course.
So very exciting to extend the Seattle team, Vancouver.
Right?
No.
Tell me there's a Lethbridge.
The Western Hockey League may not be as
there's a team in Moose Jaw, right? Sorry, we don't have time for this. We don't have time for this. No Moose Jaw.
Did you get a Saskatoon reference in there?
Don't have time for it.
Okay. So there you go. Seattle officially a professional women's hockey town. Very exciting. All right. Let's get to the Seahawks. Because you had takes just bursting within you that I did not allow you to get out, that I forced you to write an elaborate multi-paragraph post on the Discord.
I did not write a multi-paragraph. People are already talking about it. And so the conversation was already happening. If you're not on the Discord, get on the Discord. But if you want to learn about grade inflation, I guess, I was like, I'm just scrolling through all this. It's wild times in there, in whatever channel you may be in. Might not pertain to whatever that topic is. Usually,
you're saying that something based on the Pelton cast might drift off topic at times.
I will say, I was like, I'm not on that many Discords, but I will say that the Pelton cast Discord is as representative of the Pelton cast as you would want it to be.
I would agree with that.
Does that make sense?
Entirely.
Okay.
Except just way more expertise than the Pelton cast. You don't think you're disputing? I mean, I'm not an expert in grades and their merit is used for entry. But guess what? Third Pelton brother Ben Baldwin is.
There are people with expertise. You have expertise on some things. Me too. Not everybody has an expertise on everything.
Right. That's why the Discord is great.
Anyway, so I was so upset. I literally couldn't sleep on Thursday night. About
you were as upset as me the time the Blazers didn't play the Jazz in the first round of the playoffs.
So stupid. I
thought they were going to lose to the Thunder. I didn't expect them to get one of the great moments in Seattle sports history.
Of myriad reasons. Wow, just how wrong you were. Look, maybe Gray's able to turn out amazing. Left tackle somehow. But
he'll play both left guard and left tackle simultaneously. The Seahawks will be able to
put... Yeah, the first ever player, like Travis Hunter, he plays two offensive line positions for one price. I was very upset about the pick that they made, and then they did the rest of the draft. And it's so hard to still care after that much time, which it was probably good that we didn't podcast right away, because again, I was so upset about it. I called it the worst draft pick in the John Schneider era.
There is no chance of that.
There's
that bar
probably
has been
no
set so high.
I do think so. Here's the thing:
there's no way it could ever be worse, even from a process standpoint, than taking a run-stuffing defensive edge in the first round, who wasn't even good at stopping the run.
I don't know if that's true because, I mean, yes, it's close. Basically, can I give two different versions of the draft, of the perspective of the draft that the Seahawks had?
Okay.
Which I feel like is completely divorced from whatever pundits have said about the Seahawks draft, which has pretty much unanimously been positive.
I think they had the third highest GPA, which sparked the great inflation discussion.
Perspective one about the draft, and I probably am somewhere in the middle, actually, or whatever, or I just don't care that much. But perspective one is, I don't believe in the concept of, you don't draft players, you draft positions, and you draft positional value. At some point, like if certain players are falling far enough, those things don't matter as much, and drafting certain players does matter, right? But overall, the number one thing that you can do in a draft is individual players are going to get like plucked from there because they're going to be more successful than others. If you end up with a star at a non-premier position value, that's a great thing to have. That's still a good thing to have. But you should basically go into every draft assuming that every single one of these players is probably not going to pan out, right?
And I don't know if I'd say that, but what I would say is, to your point, it's much easier to establish positional value than it is to establish which prospect is going to be the best prospect.
Yes. You should regress your perspective about every individual player to the mean, if that makes sense. And how a player should basically be viewed is, and again, human beings don't do this. We love stories. Our brains inherently love it. But the way that a draft, when you're looking in a large enough scale, any individual player can be good, should be positional value, probably draft board ranking, something like that, some sort of combination of those two things. And the Seahawks, if you were to go through, outside of you move specialists and things like that, positional value, they had a truly awful draft. There's almost no way to argue against it, right? Because if you were to look at the least valuable positions, and the NFL tells us what's valuable by the kind of contracts that they give out to players, second contracts that people are getting. The NFL knows. They didn't draft a running back that high, so that's one thing. But, you know, premier positions, we know what they are. Obviously, quarterback, wide receiver, left tackle, tackle in general, defensive edge, cornerback. Those are the positions that are the most valuable positional positions in the draft. And the Seahawks did not draft any of those players until the 92nd pick in the draft, which isn't bad.
I mean, it's still a pretty high pick. They just happened to have an unusual.
They had a lot
of
picks before
then. 92. They ended up with fewer than they started with because they traded two that were before 92 to move up.
So when I look at this, like, do I think Nick Emmanuel is going to be a good player? I do, and I'm excited about him. But the just process wise, I think the Seahawks, they went through an era. They were phenomenal at drafting. John Schneider, phenomenal at drafting for a chunk of time. Then they got bad at drafting. Then they kind of got normal at drafting. And I think we're actually still in the normal at drafting era right now. This is a normal draft for the most part. However, the piece that got lost in here is that positional value piece. And so Gray Zabel may end up being a very good guard for the Seahawks. He may move to center and also be very good at center. Any of those things are true. He'd be more valuable at center than guard, probably. But there's a reality
I don't know about that. You're just saying that based on the track record of first-round centers is better than first-round guards?
Yes.
But there's also a smaller list of first-round centers, right?
But the
I mean, obviously,
other
there's two guard positions to one center position.
If they hit in, like, a positive way on all of these players, right? Every single one of them is, like, pretty good. They're not stars. They all kind of become issues with the second contract. And however good any of them are, aside from Milroe, Jalen Milroe is an outlier here.
That we should include Nick Emmanuel in this part of the discussion because it's not clear that he's not going to play cornerback.
Didn't the team tell us he was going to be playing safety?
The team said he was going to start out playing as kind of a nickel slash dime safety. So similar to the role that we saw Rayshon Jenkins play last year.
I think for now, again, all these things can evolve, but for now, if that's what his position is going to be, that's it. And the same thing for tight end. I don't mind. I like all of these players individually. So then the other side of it is draft people think it was a good draft. They feel like the Seahawks got good players. I don't know if I
necessarily... They don't think it was a good draft. They think it was a great draft.
It's really hard for me to even process why anybody would think that. Like, what about this collection of players do people think made it a great draft? Because it wasn't even necessarily, you know, I look at some like Malachi Starks, right? The Ravens took. I'm like, that not positional value, amazing player, but big board wise, a very good player, probably going to have an impact on that first contract. And I think Nick Emmanuel is somebody who could be the case with as well. But if all of them hit in like pretty positive ways, right? If they are above average,
well, have to say except Jalen Milroe, because if Jalen Milroe,
except Jalen Milroe,
but literally no other pick matters in this draft if Jalen Milroe hits, which I don't think he likely will. But
so what I'm saying, if all of these players are above average for where they were taken, that doesn't necessarily make the team that good. Does that make sense?
Because I mean, I think of that part of the issue here is that the Seahawks drafted enough for positional value the last three drafts that
you don't get enough positional value. You're not like, we're good. Well,
sure you do. Yeah, there's only so many tackles you can play. We'll see what Abe Lucas's health is. There's only so many defensive edges they can play.
I agree with this perspective. You always, yeah, the Mariners could never have too many players. All of a sudden.
I mean, I sure.
That's how this works.
Pitchers get injured? Wow, that's a thing that happens. I mean, obviously, they've got a lot of outfield injuries. We'll get to that. I do think there is an element
one
to
day
which
you think you're set at outfield, and the next day you're calling up Rylan Thomas. I'm just.
It's Dom Canton erasure.
It's an erasure. Nobody's forgetting about him. He just.
I think the Mariners are forgetting about him. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying you forgot about him.
I think they're aware. We've got Mastroboni. We're good.
Okay. I'm just saying it's a very troubling sign for Dom Canton that they've had this many injuries and he is not in the major leagues right now. Not feeling great about his long-term outlook.
But so does that make sense, though, what I'm saying? And there, again, there are two perspectives on this draft. Because, again, I like a lot of these players individually.
So as we look at how this draft is graded, I do think that people writing about the draft tend to overvalue, number one, getting a player who is a relatively good prospect for a low-value position as opposed to a relatively middling prospect at a high-value position. And then, secondly, that they tend to resist the idea of positional value because it like works against what they're doing, which is identifying positions of need. And third, that they obsess over those filling those positions of need because of the fact that it's something interesting to talk about. And I know about this as somebody who writes about the draft. Just saying, hey, I liked this draft pick because I thought this is going to be a good player. It gets pretty old. So it's more interesting to talk about how teams have filled needs than it is to talk about the quality of the players themselves. Which is, as we again acknowledge.
But we know the Seahawks have so many more needs than just this collection of players. Like, I don't think this collection of players is like, check, we're done.
I don't think so either. But I also think they can be like, we don't like the wide receivers in our range relative to the wide receivers that we know are going to be out there every year. Because wide receivers aren't going anywhere. There's always going
to
be wide. There's always going
to
be
another field
one.
A roster this year. Well,
then,
and when we're we're talking
they did
about
that
health.
By signing Cooper Kupp and Marquez Valdes-Scantling, and they're only going to play two wide receivers at any given time. So, and also Jake Bobo.
There is going to be a time that multiple wide receivers are injured. I do not buy that you can have too many wide receivers. I don't buy that you can have too many of any good positions.
I do think it is very likely that Gray Zabel is going to make more impact right away on the Seattle Seahawks than any player, than any wide receiver they could have drafted. I think the other part of this equation that you're not acknowledging.
A lot of these first round guards are bad. They're not, they're bad players in the NFL. And they required a first round pick.
I don't know what to make of that, whether guard, I believe that guard is a position that, like tight end, we just can't separate the good players from the bad players. Because what is true is that, like, the very best tight ends of all time, the very best tight ends, the most elite, the Hall of Famers, are all drafted in like the third and fourth round, maybe the late second round. None of them were drafted in the first round. That's a difference than at guard, where truly elite guards do tend to be drafted in the first rounds. Competent guards, like quality starting guards, are less relatively likely to come in the first round than in the middle rounds.
You have to be that confident about Gray Zabel that he's going to be better than those competent guards. And that's where it's like, like an off the street guard.
But that's part of the issue. Well, an off the street guard, I mean, we've learned that bar is pretty low. But like,
but
the idea
the
of,
bar is not that high for Gray. Like, Gray Zabel has to be phenomenal for it to be a good pick.
I don't think I agree with that, because one of the things that changed, and you have to reflect the draft as it happens, is guards went way higher than anyone expected. And when you look at that big board value, like, people were thinking, oh, there might be, you know, two guards in the first round. And one of those was Kelvin Banks Jr.
The positional value always catches up to you. You know what I mean? Like, the next contract, even if running backs are drafted high, NFL teams tell us what they value in free agency. And with the next contract.
Running backs aren't drafted as high as guards were in this draft. And I think that things can change over time and that the draft may start to reflect that before contracts do. But contracts also might be reflecting that. And that's why the Seahawks didn't end up.
You have a lot more faith in teams drafting. And I think teams are not smarter. Teams are better at assessing positional value in free agency than they are in the draft. You can't deny that. Teams are bad at assessing positional value in the draft.
Like the fact that whatever the guard was who's injured, who the Seahawks, you know, wanted to wait to give a physical to, I've lost.
Will Freeze?
Yeah. Fries, right?
Okay.
The fact that, you know.
I don't know if it's pronounced Fries or Freeze, but okay.
I mean, I looked this up when he was a free agent. The fact that another team was willing to pay him the contract that they did without a physical is telling of the value that they were placing on guard in free agency. And I think it was not that guards weren't valued in free agency. It's that there weren't that many good guards, people thought, in this year's particular free agency.
Fair enough. I mean, we're talking about one player.
But we're talking about, you know, a handful of guards. Like, these are ultimately all going to be small sample sizes.
But I think basically the Seahawks, like we talked about last week, they've gotten unlucky with later round guards, and they're trying to fix that. They're chasing it right now. They're chasing the fix by being like, okay, if we spend in the first round, can we get competent guard play?
But I think they're also like reacting to the fact that they tried your guy off the street model, but it failed and undermined their season.
They're shitty at drafting guards in the third and fourth round. Why are they not also
shitty?
I don't think they are shitty at drafting guards in the third and fourth round.
I think that they whiffed badly on Anthony Bradford or maybe Christian Haynes. I don't know. Maybe one of those guys, maybe both they whiffed badly on. But Damian Lewis.
If they were unwilling to extend Damian Lewis.
I think they changed their mind because it went so badly. That's what I'm telling. And yes, that might be an overreaction.
I think it's an overreaction. It's fine. It's whatever. I've talked about this a lot. I think that contract-wise for a guard, it doesn't make sense. I think the fact that there were probably trade downs that were there for a guard, I don't think it makes sense.
We should mention this context here because how I felt about the Gray Zobel pick in the moment, it evolved over time, first with the number of guards that were drafted because like we were thinking Jonah Savainaya might be like a third round option for the Seahawks. And he was off the board before they drafted in the second round.
It doesn't change positional value just because teams draft badly. Because again,
there's this thing about one of the sayings is, oh, there's not any good offensive line play. Like GMs will talk about this all the time, you know, oh, because of like too much 7-on-7 drill and, you know, you don't get to practice time anymore because of the CBA. And it's like, well, offensive line play is not in a vacuum. Offensive line play is only relative to the other offensive linemen. And I will say the same about the guards available to draft. They're not in a vacuum. They're only relative to the guards in the draft. And the guards all went much higher than expected. So that is the NFL trying to say something. And you can either listen to that or not. But
you're overjudging one draft vis-a-vis a long-term trend, which maybe guards are becoming more valuable. But when
I think that is the argument, is that interior offensive line, because of the way that it disrupts
you still have a salary cap. And the way that you factor your salary cap is you spend most of the money on the quarterback. And there are a lot of wide receivers are still valuable.
I mean, the other part of it
is valuable. Edge rushers are still valuable. Tackles are still valuable. You have to.
But maybe tackles are not as relatively valuable as they used to be because
tackles also got drafted. What are you talking about? Like, yes, guards went higher. There were three tackles in the top 10. So how is that the case?
I mean, but the point is, if tackles can be that valuable, there's no inherent reason that guards have to be less valuable. There's nothing like in the rules that say tackles have to be more valuable than guards. The reason is because exterior pressure historically has been the bigger factor. But if interior pressure becomes a bigger issue for quarterbacks in modern schemes, then that can change. That's constantly evolving. And that's what I don't think you're willing to acknowledge.
Sure.
But the other piece of this,
edge rush is still going to be important in the NFL. I'm not willing to say. And again, the same thing, the value of those other positions doesn't go down, but the salary cap dictates that it always needs to be in. And quarterbacks are becoming more expensive, right? Relative to the cap, quarterbacks are becoming more expensive. So everything else has to shrink, right? And if everything else is shrinking, like
I mean,
you're saying
the
that
answer the Seattle Seahawks gave you this year. If you look at the, I mean, I don't know if you saw the chart that was going around social media today. Probably you didn't since you're not on Twitter. Like the Seahawks spent a higher percentage of their draft capital than any other team on offense. And they spent a higher percentage of their free agency spending than any other team on offense. Now that's partially because of the fact that they lost Geno Smith and DK Metcalf and, you know, were reallocating money.
They signed
money
a
was
quarterback.
Already...
So like the amount of money, how many teams, Sam Darnold was the highest paid quarterback in free agency.
Yes. But the Seattle Seahawks are telling you they're spending all their money on offense and very little on defense. This is the Mike McDonald point that we had talked about.
No, I was actually surprised. I mean, they still like Nick Amendola is basically he's like hybrid first round pick.
Well, we'll get to that in a second. But what the Seahawks have told you is the thing they're devaluing is defense in this year's draft. That's the thing they devalued. They're not spending on linebacker, which, you know, obviously they did with Ernest Jones IV and re-signing him. But like they're going with Tyrus Knight. They're at cornerback. They didn't invest a pick there. They're probably going to sign Shaquille Griffin.
And honestly, like if it were me, this is how ideally you want it to be structured, right? Which is basically spend everything on the position or on the side of the ball that the coach isn't from, right? And that's why it ended up being ironic with Pete Carroll for many of his best teams. The offense was actually better than the defense. But the spend all the money on the side of the ball that the coach isn't from. I'm just shocked that they did it because most of the other teams drafted offensive players. You know what I mean? Like the Jags moved up, I guess, however you want to factor Travis Hunter, whatever you want to call him. But like primarily an offensive player. Many of the other teams were like, we're going to go
the teams with offensive coaches.
Yes, we're going to go get the player for our offensive new offensive coach. So
I mean, it's also Mike McDonald isn't a new coach. Like the defense was good. They don't need to fix the defense. It is not broken currently. So it's interesting. But to your other point that you were raising is that the other piece of context that changed the feelings about the Grays Able pick was your division rival in the LA Rams subsequently making one of the most amazing trades in modern NFL draft history to get a first round pick in 2026 from the Atlanta Falcons plus the 46th pick for the 26th pick. They go down 20 spots and get a whole ass first round pick for next year, which very plausibly could be better than the pick almost certainly will be better than the pick they gave up.
Oh, Penix slander.
I mean, they'd have to get to the NFC Championship game, I think, to assure that it would be worse.
Oh my god.
Like, you know,
it was just
like if they lose in the second round of the playoffs,
how
could
you have that job and be so fucking stupid? How could you get there to that job? And I mean, obviously we had like probably one of the stupidest GM moments of all time happen this year, so it happens, but like Jesus Christ. We're here arguing about positional value for a guard, and these motherfuckers traded a future first for James Pierce.
I mean, the thing is, when I heard that they
move up 20 spots,
I assume that the reason people were like so shocked is that they had done it to draft Shedeur Sanders, and that they were going to like have both him and Michael Penix Jr. Yeah. Because I just assumed like there's no way you would trade for a first round pick not to draft a quarterback.
We don't know if that trade was available for the Seahawks. If they, you know, the communication between the teams, I doubt that they went through everybody.
But it seems likely because the concern usually with teams is, well, we can't move that far back. And I think the Seahawks of all teams were well equipped to move that far back because of the fact that they had so much extra
draft capital
in the second and third round that they could do precisely what they did. So, yeah, I mean, we went through my preference board. They decided against drafting Jahad Campbell, who dropped considerably. Medical was certainly a factor there, as it was for Will Johnson.
I don't want to say he dropped considerably. He dropped a bit.
I think he did, given where he was on big boards. I had Campbell ahead of the trade down option. I had Gray Zabel below the trade down option, so I would have preferred a trade down. Now they end up trading back up to 34 or 35 early in the second round to trade to get Emenwori. And what it cost them there was pick 52 and 82, which is worth about the 19th or 20th pick. So basically they traded for the equivalent of the pick they already had with the 18th pick. So clearly they must have thought that if Zabel wasn't there, they were going to take Emenwori. That's the only argument to explain this.
Fair enough. I mean, maybe they're wrong. That's the thing. And the problem with assessing the draft.
Of course they're probably wrong.
The thing about grading the draft is you were saying And I also was thinking about, like, from the team's perspective, is I don't know if I actually heard John Schneider say this specifically, but I do think teams sometimes are like, oh, fans don't like drafting guards, but we have to because it's like, it's an important thing to do. And it's like, no, your process was actually bad. And ultimately, until the Milroe pick, their process was bad in most of, to give up that kind of value for Nick Emmanuel. Maybe it's appropriate because, again, he could have been a first round pick, but when we're looking at positional value, if he ends up as a corner, it's not the same. We don't know. He's going to start as a safety. So this idea that hypothetically somebody is going to get there.
I mean, he's also going to start as a like nickel is sort of a corner position. Obviously it's not as valuable, but
also drafted a nickel with the fifth pick in the draft, like,
which we wholeheartedly endorse.
Oh yeah.
I mean, that's another place where it's the situation is changing because being near the football on defense now is seen often as more valuable than being a traditional corner. So these things are evolving. Should we go through the picks by pick, or do you want to talk big picture some more?
I don't know. I feel like we've talked big picture. I guess the flip side of it. So that's me arguing the negative side. The flip side is I'm excited about all these players. I mean, I'm not excited about Gray Zabel, but it's like, it's fine. He better fucking start.
It would be
right
great
away.
If guard was, I mean, I don't, yeah. Like, look, they decided to put him at left guard, which is where Laken Tomlinson was last year, not where the other guys, you know, their other recent draft picks in Sauatoa Lemea have been. They're certainly, everything they're signaling is that Gray Zabel is going to start from day one.
Yes.
So thing here is he is a native of South Dakota, having played at North Dakota State. But I thought I'd put this in the notes. It's not particularly close to where our family is from in South Dakota, alas.
He's been to a wall drug, though. Come on.
Oh, well, obviously. And the other important thing is that he celebrated, said he was going to celebrate by, quote, diving into these Busch Lights. And then his brother later posted on social media that they had run out, which...
They drank
truly an impressive feat.
They drank every Busch Light. No, it's, I'm sure, again, Gray Zabel will be fine. The amount that we talk about Gray Zabel, you know, like Steve Hutchinson is obviously like the pick that people are going to cite the most for this. That was a phenomenal success.
Yes.
For that pick. He's a fucking Hall of Famer.
I think that's part of it is like the Seahawks have not used that many first round picks on guards. So Seahawks fans can imagine that all of the first round picks you use on guards are Steve Hutchinson, and they are not.
Yes. If he is anywhere near approximating Steve Hutchinson, obviously it would be the right thing to do, but.
Emmanuel, perfect 10 relative athletic score. I don't think we really talked about this on last week's pod. Shamar Stewart, who ended up going higher than expected, I would say, was the other player to score a 10. The headline is the 4.38 40 that he ran at the combine, but I would note that he had a 43 inch max vertical, which was the best for any player at this year's combine and would be a top 20 result in NBA draft combine history. For comparison, Nate Robinson, our old friend, his max vert at the combine, 43.5 inches. So this guy is a serious fucking athlete in some regards. A lot of questions about his agility and his ability to change directions, which will be interesting to see how it sort of plays out. Many people thought that maybe he would be better as sort of a press corner in a cover three type of scheme.
I mean, it'll be interesting to see how Mike McDonald uses him. And I think that obviously Mike McDonald wanted somebody who is that athletic out there. And I think they went out and got him. You know, they made sure that they went and got him with that pick. Targeting any individual player, like your success rate is probably going to be fairly low. But if he has an idea of how he can be used in the scheme, and I think Mike McDonald's already thinking about how to coach Nick Emmanuel and has an idea for where he's going to be. So, like, if I had to pick any player from this draft who I expected to be an above average contributor to the team and have a chance to make a Pro Bowl, he's Nick Emmanuel's number one.
I mean, I still think it's Gray Zabel in terms of, but to your positional value point, I can see situations where Emmanuel's positional value, be wherever he ends up, is higher than Zabel's. Yeah, I mean, you triggered a thought in there that I was going to say something about, but because Jahad Campbell, the reason I had him higher than Trey Down on my preference board was the idea that he could be this multi-positional weapon for Mike McDonald. And I think Emmanuel does fit into that as well.
Yes.
If they had traded down to get Nick Emmanuel, I would be so hyped. With the 50th pick, they took Miami tight end Elijah Arroyo, a move tight end who barely contributed for 3 years while dealing with knee injuries before breaking out for 35 catches with 35 catches for 590 yards, 7 touchdowns last season playing with Cam Ward, a massive 16.9 yards per reception. Like, if you look
I kind
of
remember this guy too. After like seeing his name, I was like, because I ended up watching a lot of Miami games, and I was like, oh, I kind of remember this dude being kind of a demon out there.
You look at his career yards per reception was over 16. Obviously, it wasn't a lot of career outside of this, but whatever Hall of Fame receiving tight end you want to see, they do not have a yards per reception that high in college. Like, Gronk had one of his seasons at Arizona was above this, but not for his entire career. So we'll see if he can stay healthy, if he can develop enough as a blocker to stay on the field constantly, but particularly being in a scheme where there's going to be a lot of 12 personnel with multiple tight ends. I think that Elijah Arroyo might be the wide receiver.
Yes.
They took.
It's an interesting point. He definitely is different than somebody like AJ Barner necessarily. He's filling a role that Barner's not going to fill.
Per the Beast and Dan Brugler on The Athletic lined up primarily in the slot last year. So maybe he literally will be a wide receiver at times, but
yeah, not technically a wide receiver, but he's somebody who's athletic enough and can get open too, can get open downfield. I think it'll be pretty fun. I think Elijah Arroyo is going to be fun.
You know who else is probably going to be fun, whether the pick works or not? Is Jalen Milroe.
Oh, we
like
wanted a quarterback.
Seahawks preseason.
We were desperate for a quarterback for so long. I mean, this is it. This is since Russell Wilson. This is all we've gotten. We knew exactly what Geno Smith was, right? We knew what we were getting there with those players.
Quickly they gloss over the Alex Magoo era. and what an era it was. Like, so the Seahawks chose him over Shedeur Sanders. I don't know. Do we want to have a conversation about that?
I mean, I don't care.
I would say that
it wouldn't have made a difference to me whether they drafted him. They would have been excited if they drafted Shedeur also.
Correct.
But I always have been more excited about Jalen Milroe than Shedeur. Because Shedeur is a problem. When you have Shedeur on the team, not even like, I don't mean that from the perspective of like in the locker room or whatever. You have to get Shedeur on the field a little bit faster than you have to get Jalen Milroe on the field.
They're going to get Jalen Milroe on the field right away. Apparently they've talked about giving him 10% of snaps and variety of packages to take advantage of his rushy ability.
That's a we'll see type of thing, but
I agree that it's a we'll see type of thing. I that is something I am counting on.
I think there's a good chance of it, but everything like that, every situation that people are like, we're going to do this thing, all of a sudden you might just need to play football at some point. And I think that they are capable of it. The thing that we should be talking about is not that with Jalen Milroe. It is Jalen Milroe as quarterback. And I think that's why with Shedeur, like if you have Sam Darnold and Shedeur Sanders and Drew Lock, then it's a little bit of like, you have to be thinking about a timeline for Shedeur more than I think you have to for Milroe.
I would agree with that. I mean, the reason it makes sense for a package is in terms of pure rushing ability from a quarterback, he is in the Lamar Jackson class, I would say. Like Lamar Jackson was much more dominant, was a much better overall quarterback at Louisville.
It's honestly not even close, but yes. Like, but when you look at the rushing yards that Lamar had in college, like,
I mean, he was, not yes, even, he's one of one.
They're not in the same conversation. I wanted them to be. I went and looked at all this stuff, and I wanted them to be just like a little bit closer to be like, "Oh, everybody just didn't notice," you know. But I think Milroe was actually drafted at almost precisely the right place.
I agree. Number two among Power Conference players in rush EPA last year, according to ESPN's model, 23rd in pass EPA. So he finished at the back end of the top 10 in QBR, both of his seasons as a starter, which probably when you account for the rushing bias, probably puts him in the same category as Shedeur Sanders, who was around 20th last year. You look at their offenses, Alabama was 18th in 2023, 20th last year. So that's kind of the same territory that Colorado was in last year, but 32 rushing touchdowns. 32 rushing touchdowns. That's unreal. Army's option quarterback is the only other quarterback with more than 23 in that span, according to StatHead.com. Finished sixth in Heisman voting in his first year as a starter as a third-year sophomore after replacing Bryce Young. Then improved his rushy output last year but had more turnovers and was not in Heisman consideration in a disappointing Alabama season. 65% completion percentage, relatively low for a modern QB, I would say, and not necessarily the yards per completion to make up for it. A lot of people compare him to Jalen Hurts, one of his predecessors out of Alabama.
But I looked up the Jalen Hurts stats. Wow, they are good.
Yeah, Hurts completed 70% of his passes at Oklahoma before entering the NFL. Like, and Yeah,
just a better coaching scheme for his last year in college for Hurts, you know.
You know, I will say Milroe's passing stats not as different in terms of on a rate basis as from Michael Penix Jr. as you might think. The one thing I didn't dig deep into, it sounds like his third and fourth down passing numbers were not great, which obviously was Michael Penix Jr.'s strength.
There's some development that needs to happen. And again, I looked at all these players on Friday night, just being excited about Jalen Milroe to be like, again, one of those things you're just like looking for the stat that it's like, whoa, nobody noticed this or whatever, to like give me like a lot of hope about it. And it's kind of like, it's a project, you know, like that is realistically Jalen Milroe is a project as an NFL quarterback.
What is the correct line for career starts for Jalen Milroe?
Oh, I think it's pretty high.
Really?
I think it's career starts.
Yeah. Okay. Seahawks starts.
It's probably like 5.5 for the Seahawks.
That's where I was headed. Yes.
But the one that I was looking at, and obviously he's not as like physically built, but like Anthony Richardson, it is bonkers when you look at his stats where he was drafted.
It is. And how excited we were to draft him.
And to consider it, because Jalen Milroe's rushing stats are better than Anthony Richardson's rushing stats, yes. And his passing stats are better. But when you look at those players that we're talking about, like comparing him to Jalen Hurts and Lamar Jackson just isn't fair to any quarterback, because Lamar Jackson's won an MVP and Jalen Hurts just won the Super Bowl.
Yep.
So like, of course he's not as good as those quarterbacks. The real issue that happened with those two quarterbacks is they were wildly undervalued coming into the league. And I think the league just clearly got it wrong with both of those players. But I mean, when you look at like the Lamar, you know, he ran for almost 1,000 more yards than Milroe did in his last 1,600 rushing yards.
Jeez.
His last season at Louisville. And Jalen Milroe is like 726. So it's not really even close in terms of a rusher. Lamar Jackson is he's fucking MVP. He's maybe the best quarterback in the league. Right. So there's not really a conversation. I don't think Jalen Milroe is going to be as good as Lamar Jackson is.
Hot takes from the Pelton cast. All right, then we saw a variety of trades, one of them involving...
No, I still want to talk about Jalen Milroe, though. Like, it is going to be so much fun having him on the roster. It is probably going to make us want him to play in games when he probably shouldn't. And he is almost certainly going to be a worse quarterback than Sam Darnold. But if Darnold gets hurt at some point or something, knock on wood, or is playing so badly, also knock on wood.
I mean, you know, like the best case scenario for this is the Demond Williams Jr. situation, right? Where he came in with this idea that he's going to play a fair bit. He's a project. And then was so good that he demanded the starting quarterback job.
The best case scenario is that he's the greatest quarterback of all time.
Okay.
Oh, shit.
See, I should be taking now for 2028.
I mean...
2027, probably. I don't know.
He's going to be undervalued because of his size in the same way that like Jalen Hurts was. But it's the QBR numbers are not comparable between Jalen Milroe and Demond Williams. They are not. But
I mean, it's a pretty small sample size. I'm not ready to go there with Demond Williams Jr.
It is a larger sample size than you think.
Is he qualified on the QBR page? Is
Absolutely
he still
going
to look him up separately? Yeah, that's what I thought.
But Jalen Milroe is somebody who you would sort of describe as, you would describe them as like QBR merchant, right?
Yeah, I believe I have, yes.
As a person who's a much better runner, QBR likes those sort of things. However, he was also one of the best runners in college last year.
Yeah.
Just saying that he's not Lamar Jackson doesn't mean he's bad.
Right.
And when you look at kind of like, say, the top 15 of QBR in college, like Shadur is not even close. Shadur is less. He's not the QBR merchant in the way that Jalen Milroe is.
Which is why I think the offensive team efficiency in FPI is an interesting contrast, where Alabama and Colorado were pretty similar.
Let me see that.
And obviously, like, Alabama probably has better team-wide talent, but Colorado did have the Heisman Trophy winner who went number 2 in the draft.
It's not necessarily the system, and it wasn't, his stats weren't that radically different under Nick Saban or Kalen DeBoer either.
Correct.
So, but it's not necessarily the type of quarterback for either of those systems that they're used to working with. So we'll see, you know, Clint Kubiak developing him, and he may be a surprise. Like, there is a window that Jalen Milroe is a Pro Bowl quarterback. And for other players, like Tyler Shook, it's like, I like Tyler Shook. He's a career backup.
I do think that Brock Purdy being Mr. Irrelevant and being as good as he is shows that the idea that, like, oh, you don't have a ceiling because you don't have the physical tools, like, that doesn't exist.
But just when I look at this, you know, QBR is not the be-all end-all, but, like, you see it and you're like, Cam Ward clearly was the best quarterback. There's almost no argument against it. And the rest of the people who are around him, like, he's not that far off from Jackson Dart. And Will Howard went later, but like Drew Aller is considered possible number one pick next year. Like Jalen Milroe is in that conversation with those quarterbacks.
All right, we got to speed through the rest of this. So the Seahawks made a variety of trades in the fourth round. They sent Sam Howell now that they had drafted Milroe and the 172nd pick to the Vikings for the 142nd pick. Per the Jimmy Johnson chart, that values Howell as a sixth round pick, which is a little better than I was expecting with my flip a seventh for a sixth idea for Howell. So good for the Seahawks to get some value there. That helped enable them to trade their own 137th pick for 5, 144, and 7, 238. And then they subsequently traded 5, 144, 4, 5, 166, and 6, 192. So they really loaded up in the later rounds here, drafting three players in the fifth and three in the seventh, as well as one in the sixth. In the fifth, they got Notre Dame defensive end Riley Mills, who played defensive tackle at Notre Dame, had a career high in team leading 7.5 sacks as a fifth year senior before tearing his ACL in the CFP first round. John Schneider said a midseason return is realistic for him. So it's the only other defensive player they drafted besides Evan Worry. With pick 166, they get Colorado State wide receiver Torrey Horton, but his first two seasons in Nevada, then three at Colorado State, led the Mountain West in receiving yards in 2022, led in receptions in 2023 before playing just six games in 2024 due to season-ending knee surgery, came back to run a 4.4140 at the combine, 9.83 relative athletic score, also returned three punts for touchdowns in college, so he was number 88 on Danny Kelly's big board. And this is my favorite stat. Completed 5 of 6 passes for a touchdown and an interception.
Hello.
So I'd love to see some trick plays involving
this. This is the pick, like, of the later picks that we're most excited about, right?
I would agree. Yes, there's two, but this is number one for me. If they had drafted him in the third round, that would have been totally fine. Would have made sense. And instead, they got him in the fifth. Their next fifth round pick they used on a fullback, Robbie Utes. From Alabama, who played tight end at college, he had 16 career catches for 192 yards, did have three touchdowns on 11 catches last season, near offensive line size at 6'3", 274. So relative athletic score among fullbacks compares him to Patrick Ricard and old friend Will Tukuafu.
Great.
This is what we're talking about here.
It's good fullbacks, I guess.
I'm shocked that required a fifth round. I don't know if Tukuafu just was a fullback. He was exciting because he played defense too. Travis Hunter. In the sixth round, they took Kansas guard Bryce Cabledue, who was a four-year starter at tackle, move inside in the NFL after doing so in the Shrine Bowl. Just like Gray Zabel, an excellent athlete when you consider him as a guard, 9.91 relative athletic score. Seventh round, Miami running back Damian Martinez, who we're more familiar with from his time at Oregon State, where he spent his first 2 years. Three-year college player. Interesting to see someone come out early without a lot of mileage. Over 6 yards per carry all three seasons. Topped 1,000 yards twice with 26 career TDs, but not a particularly good athlete. Just an 8.19 relative athletic score. Still, this is the type of running back pick I feel like you should make every single
year. Oh, I love Damian Martinez. I mean, again, having watched a lot of the Miami games, like, those two, I'm surprised we didn't get Restrepo too, but having it's funny they went hard on, you know, two different schools, two players from two schools that they both on offense, right? But this is great. Like, to me, the chances of Damian Martinez long term being as good as any of the running backs who are currently on the Seahawks roster, extraordinarily high, and depending on, you know, opportunity or relative to almost anybody taken in this draft. A running back.
The Seahawks did not trade Ken Walker III, which means that I do have to watch Life or something like it. It was disappointing.
Yes.
When I was remembering it the next day and putting it, or 2 days later and putting it in the notes, I thought that we had bet on whether Sam Howell was going to get traded, which I would have won, and not whether Ken Walker III.
You remembered the outcome of the trade that would have been successful for, or the bet that would have been successful for you?
Yeah.
Weird. What are the odds? Vegas.
All right, staying in the seventh round, Iowa tackle Mason Richmond. There was some thought he would stay inside, he would move inside, but the Seahawks plan to start him at tackle after taking the two other guards. Started all 52 games he played over the past four seasons, but a poor athlete for a tackle, just a 6.42 relative athletic score. And then finally, with the 238th pick, Seahawks took UNLV wide receiver Ricky White III. Notably here, White was suspended for his 2021 season while at Michigan State. ESPN reported that October that an unnamed player filed a Title IX lawsuit alleging he was unfairly suspended from the team while university investigators decided on sexual misconduct allegations against him and said in the lawsuit that the sexual encounter was consensual. White transferred to UNLV and led the Mountain West in receiving yards in 2023. Was not as productive as a fifth-year senior, but had 11 touchdowns and also blocked four punts. His slight frame at listed 6'1", 185, in addition to the Michigan State investigation, worked against his NFL prospects. All right, a couple of priority undrafted free agents to mention that the Seahawks are reportedly giving large bonuses and or guarantees of their salary to. LSU cornerback Zai Alexander. This is maybe the most exciting one. Dade Brugler had a fifth-round grade on him in the Beast. 13 career interceptions. Had an ACL tear in 2023 and then ran just a 4.56 40 at the combine. So Brugler reported some teams were looking at him as a safety. We'll see where he ends up for the Seahawks. Utah edge Connor O'Toole, a converted wide receiver who peaked with 4.5 sacks in 8 games in 2023, had 2.5 in 8 games last season. Relative athletic score does comp him to Nick Benito, who we talked a lot about in the draft and has developed into a Pro Bowler in Denver. And then Minnesota tight end Nick Kallerup, a blocking tight end with 14 career catches in 57 games over 5 seasons. The other bit of Seahawks news, as we continue to move quickly here, they reportedly will pick up Charles Cross's 5th-year option. First time they've done so with one of their draft picks. No surprise, as we talked about last year. Tom Pelissero of NFL Network reported they are re-signing nose tackle Jonathan Hankins, who started 8 games last season. They waived defensive tackle Cameron Young last week, and this was clearly an opening after they didn't address that position in the draft. And then lastly, our old friend Tyler Lockett is headed to Tennessee. He signed a 1-year deal with the Titans with a $4 million base, $6 million max value. The Seahawks will play at Tennessee this season. So possible Tyler Lockett revenge game.
There we go. That'll be fun playing Cam Ward. Tyler Lockett ended up where all wide receivers end up. And
it really did.
I'm calling the signing for DK Metcalf. 2 years, 3 years?
Yeah, I think 2029.
29 is the year that DK signs the Titans.
I hope this happens.
There'll be some excitement about it. Pairing Cam Ward and DK Metcalf. Every single one of the players that teams were open to trading during the draft, this is following up on the thing from last week, every single one did not get traded.
Sam Howell got traded.
That's true. Yeah, Sam Howell, that was one player that was open to being traded.
Not that many players got traded this year. That's interesting.
It's almost like teams are willing to trade any player if you give them an obscene haul for somebody. The only thing that happened was the fucking Rams somehow. How does this keep happening to us in division?
I mean, the Rams usually are the ones trading all the stuff for the picks, not the other way around.
Not anymore.
It's only a matter of time. Do we have your favorite segment? Did I transition too quickly for you? You were ready for this? Should I fill with some additional, I don't know, do I have any other notes here on the Seahawks draft? I don't think I do. So I guess I will continue filling here. As we record this, the Seattle Mariners are playing baseball.
Hold on. I had to rush these before our call, so I might have forgotten sections.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
Well, it has been 1 month now of baseball, and you know what that means. It's time to take a victory lap. Because after a month, I get to utter my favorite 4 words when strung together. I told you so.
It's not all first place Seattle Mariners.
All offseason was not enough hitting this. Didn't spend enough that. Well, where the fuck are those people now that the Mariners are the second best hitting team in baseball? And what did I tell you? No holes on this roster. And it turns out I was more right than I could have possibly imagined. There were no holes on the 40-man roster and beyond. I said 6 aces. And sadly, I was wrong. Because the team has 7 aces. Sorry, Luis F. Castillo, there can only be one. But there can be 2 Logans. The Mariners have done it again with young pitching. They said the team needed pitching health to be good. Well, check the scoreboard, motherfucker. They said this roster couldn't hit. They didn't have major league depth. Best get to know Ben Williamson and Leo Rivas, because this team is a hitting machine fueled by three of the top 25 hitters in baseball. MVP Jorge Polanco, Dylan Moore, and Cal Raleigh, like we all expected. But if I could get serious for a second, they're winning the fucking World Series. 2025 is the year. They're the best hitting team in baseball in April, having played more games at home than on the road. They've been through numerous injuries. Julio has sucked. George Kirby has been out, and it doesn't even matter. They're not even winning with chaos ball anymore. They just, in the immortal words of Kirk Cignetti, get to the hotel around 8 at night, have dinner, go to bed, wake up, play at 3:30, kick their ass, and go home. And if you didn't know about the 2025 Mariners, Google them.
I haven't seen a lot of 3:30 start times for the Mariners this season. Yeah, I mean, Jorge Polanco, strictly as a lefty, strictly as a DH, has suddenly turned into Babe Ruth reincarnate. So that's an exciting development. Picking up where Cal Raleigh left off. Mariners have so far, we're going to test it, but they have shaken off a remarkable number of injuries. As you alluded to, Logan Gilbert placed on the injured list with a grade 1 forearm strain after leaving Friday's start early due to discomfort. I found a study that suggested about 20% of players diagnosed with forearm strains undergo Tommy John surgery within the next year. So definitely considerable long-term concern in addition to the time that Gilbert is going to be out. But right now they are hoping that some rest will allow this injury, which is sort of like related in terms of the strain that the additional strain that a forearm strain puts on your UCL tendon is sort of the concern, but that he can get healthy. And Logan Evans, as you said, got a win in his MLB debut on Sunday, allowing 2 runs over 5 innings. Great to see that and him perform so well. Dylan Moore is on the injured list with hip inflammation. He's expected to miss about a week. More troublingly, Luke Raley was placed on the injured list Wednesday after suffering an oblique strain during batting practice on Tuesday night. Justin Hollander said 6 weeks until he can begin rehab. So an extended period where they're going to be without both Luke Raley and Victor Robles, a serious test to any team's outfield depth, and especially to the Mariners, who had so far been okay with the Robles injury, but particularly because Jorge Polanco now has been so comfortable slotting in at DH with Williamson at third base, as you talked about. Don't look at Williamson's batting average on balls in play. It's definitely sustainable to start.
The Mariners tied the game up, and I was just like, I didn't realize Polanco was due up this inning.
Did he actually hit a home run?
No, it was in a Rosarina homer.
Oh, okay, there you go.
I feel like so many players are getting lost.
Polanco is not in the starting lineup because they're facing a lefty.
There are so many players who are just lost in the mix with how good, I mean, Dylan Moore, obviously, being injured, but like with how good Cal Raleigh has been hitting and how well Jorge Polanco has been hitting. But the team is kind of what we thought. Obviously, Polanco has been better than we could have possibly imagined
way
for
better.
The season. But I feel like it's all, with the amount of players that have been worse than we could have imagined for this time period, it doesn't feel like if Polanco regresses, that the bottom is going to fall out on the
hit. I agree with that. But yeah, I mean,
I don't think you end up number 2 in WRC plus for a month without being a pretty good hitting team. Like, I don't think that the season overall, they're going to end up being like bottom 10 in the league or something like that,
no,
given the way that they've started in April.
I think that's very unlikely, especially because they have historically hit better as the season has gone on.
It's just kind of wild, like how I'm approaching these games now. And the amount of stress that typically has been felt, like Mitch Garver just taking second base, easy. But this feels like a different Mariners team than the last 4 or 5 years. Even during this run that they've had, this feels like the best team.
I mean, they did have the August in 2023 that was pretty fucking good. And they were in first place very late in the season last year. So keep your guard up. But we have 7 minutes to get through the rest of the podcast.
Sustainable,
so.
Doesn't it? Doesn't this feel more sustainable?
I suppose it does, but those didn't feel unsustainable in the moment, I guess is what I would tell you. Farewell to the Mariners DFA and Casey Lawrence. We were going to say as he was claimed off waivers with the Blue Jays, but then Lawrence was DFA'd by the Blue Jays and surely elect to return to the Tacoma Rainiers if he clears waivers into the roundup. The
oh
NHL
my
draft
God.
Lottery. What?
A Donovan Solano hit?
There you go. Wow. That definitely
wow.
Would Quiet break.
I'm telling you.
The NHL draft lottery is Tuesday. Remember, the Kraken are sixth in entering the lottery and will have a 7.5% chance at winning the number one pick, 7.7% chance at number two, most likely to pick sixth or seventh with a 9% chance of sliding all the way to number eight. Seattle Sounders got a 1-1 draw Saturday at Colorado. Danny Masovsky scored for the third consecutive game just before halftime. Sounders then conceded the equalizer in the 54th minute, had the advantage again with 1.8 expected goals to 1.1 for Colorado, despite putting just three shots on target. Real bad news with Jordan Morris leaving in the second half, stoppage time with a hamstring injury after replacing Musovsky at halftime, still awaiting a second MRI to get a timetable for him. Sounders 3 points ahead of St. Louis SC as they host them on Saturday, despite a 1-0 road loss in March. Seattle Reign FC also drew 1-1 on Saturday at Bay FC. Jordan Heidema grabbed the equalizer in the 50th minute as the Reign earned a point on the road. They put five of their non-shots on goal. Lynn Biondolo played into stoppage time, and she gets very close to 100%. Schedule gets tougher this Friday with a visit by the league-leading Kansas City Current, who have 15 points from their first six matches and a plus-10 goal differential, both same as Orlando. Seattle Storm, we won't go too deep into it this week. They started training camp on Sunday. Dominic Malonga, number two pick, not yet in Seattle. Team doesn't have a timetable for her arrival after her international season ended last Wednesday. Still, I don't think there's any reason for concern here, but would love to see her in camp as quick as possible. They'll play their lone preseason game Sunday against the Connecticut Sun. I'll be there. I'll have a full report. UW men's basketball, McDonald's All-America pick Nico Badalo, the top-rated incoming freshman in the Huskies class, was given his release in his reopening. His recruitment certainly felt like the Huskies recruited over him with the addition of Jacob Ognacevich as a transfer. They also then brought in another freshman power forward in German, Hannes Steinbach. So, you know, maybe not terribly surprising, but, and also just, I don't know if that's a huge concern because I just don't think that freshman recruiting is how you build a college basketball team in 2025. Cool. You build it
do
with
we,
guys
Do we
like,
care about this?
Mildly.
Okay. I saw that and it was like just talking about where he was ranked and everything, and it was kind of like I feel like he was not going to be a contributing factor as part of the team this season, which is not necessarily the requirement, but if he's not, he probably would have transferred anyway.
Exactly.
So,
it's not the way you build a team.
You're just like getting ahead of the transfer.
Yeah. UW softball lost 2-3 to number 18 Nebraska in their final home series of the season. They were outslugged Friday when Nebraska opened up a 9-0 lead in the fourth. Huskies made the final respectable with a 3-run homer in the bottom of the seventh before losing 12-8. Carried that over Saturday, scoring 6 runs in the first inning and 10 through 3 innings of a 10-2 run by run rule, but then were shut out Sunday on just one hit in a 6-0 loss. They're 7th with a 10-8 Big Ten record, heading to State College for their final series of the Big Ten season. Penn State 9-10 overall, but has gone 10-3 in home games this year. UW baseball took 2 out of 3 against Northwestern in Evanston.
You remember the Diamond Dogs? Winning by a combined softball team.
Yeah, they are winning by a combined 33-8, scoring 7 innings both times on Friday and then Saturday, before losing the series finale 10-4 on Sunday. Then beat UIC 15-8 on Monday in Chicago before flying home. They host Big Ten leader Iowa this weekend. Hawkeyes are 20-4 and have swept their last two series. Huskies fifth in the Big Ten right now at 13-8, but they still have to play three of the four teams ahead of them to
finish
conference play.
On. Is there a Joe Lenardi of the how does it work with the College World Series?
Yeah, there's a
selection committee,
the same thing.
We don't even
know.
We have no idea. Okay. How many teams go to the College World Series?
Well, 8 teams go to the College World Series, but 64 go to the NCAA tournament.
Okay, it's just the Elite Eight is the College World Series.
Correct. Because it's all played in one spot.
Is there a
I have not looked at it.
There's not a college baseball bracket. I'm going to do a little bit of research here. We've got plenty of time.
I think there is. I don't think that the Huskies are in that conversation yet. UW football. The spring game is Friday at 6:30 p.m. Former Huskies Donald Butler and Michael Penix Jr. will serve as honorary captains. But the real highlight should be a halftime corgi race.
Hello. You're going, right? Are you going?
No, I'm not going. Oh, I mean, I guess it's plausible there might not be is it plausible there might not be an NBA game? I mean, I don't know that I would go anyway, but because you know my schedule, it might not always be ideal that I spend so much time watching NBA basketball during the playoffs.
Okay, I did a control F on the Baseball America bracket projected field of 64. I did W and I was like, okay, cool, we're good. 64 things in there. WA, we're down to 1 of 9. WAS, 1 of 2. And it turns out the WAS is the word was 2 times.
Oh,
when you add that
no.
H, it is 0 out of 0 things. including the last four in, the first four out, and the next four out. So some work to catch up with Creighton and McNeese State. But
well, good luck to the Diamond Dogs.
Yeah, you can't make the NCAA tournament without playing these games. Right now, an opportunity this weekend against Iowa.
All right, we made it through.
Did we?
We did. So, 2 minutes to spare.
Wow.
On that note,
they're only a three seed, Iowa.
Only a three seed.
I mean, it's not like the number one team in the Big Ten is like a one seed or something. Turns out maybe Big Ten baseball is not great.
No, it's not.
Okay, keep us posted on your review of life or something like it when you watch next week.
I am hopeful that I will before we record next week have time, and then we'll also discuss the after the pod the Andor format of three episodes at a time.
Are you all caught up?
Not from the ones that came out today or yesterday,
but the previous week one.
Yes, I've seen the first three.
They came out today. I will say that by the time I was like, it's kind of a slog, and then they get to the last 30 minutes, and I was like, yes.
I could not have a more opposite opinion, but I look forward to talking about this.
Really?
When we have more time.
You didn't like the last 30 minutes?
No, I never thought it was a slog. I looked at the clock. I was like, how is it almost over?
Okay. I could have spent a little bit less time on that planet.
I agree with that, but I was in it from minute one. Okay. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.